supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I couldn't believe I've been doing this thing for 16 years and we've never done a question of the week on African violets. So we're going to remedy that by talking about what these plants, these popular plants, need for their basic care and how to rescue them when they go into distress. Other than that, it's time for your distressed phone calls today at 1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Richard. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing all right, trying to stay warm.
Yeah, that's all of us these days. Where is Richard trying to stay warm?
Brockport, Pennsylvania.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. Whereabouts are you?
A couple miles south of Ridgeway.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now I know it. Come on, give me a hint.
You know where the Ridgeway Chainsaw Rendezvous is?
No. Are you out in central PA?
Yeah, I don't know, about 8 miles north of Interstate 80, right above Dubois.
Okay, good. Now I know where you is. All right, what can we do for Richard out in the wilds of Pennsylvania?
We were picking some cabbage last fall, and we found these strange little worms on them.
Yeah?
Then we looked online and found out they were arrowhead worms, but we really couldn't find out any more about them.
Okay. Arrowhead worms. Now, that's a term that I don't hear very often, and the only reason I kind of know of the arrowhead worm is my friend, the dirt doctor from down in Texas, an organic gardener who has a radio show like myself. These creatures are indigenous to Texas, but I don't think you're talking about the same creature. These kind of look like earthworms, but they have a really crazy hammerhead shark shape. So you have arrowhead worms in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
And these look like kind of long earthworms. And
yeah, they'll be real skinny and short, and then they can stretch out really long.
But their head looks like the head of a hammerhead shark.
Yeah.
And they're not green.
No, I don't. No, they're more brown, like almost earthworm colored.
Okay. Well, that is real. First of all, they're really cool looking, aren't they?
They're pretty wild.
I only know of them occurring in Texas, and they're rare there. And you didn't move here from Texas, did you, Rich?
No. I've lived here all my life.
And there was no damage on your cabbage, was there?
No, it actually almost looked like they had little egg sacs or seed pods laid in there, too.
It could be. Arrowhead worms are very rare, and they work both ways. But in terms of a gardener, especially in a cabbage patch, they could wind up being your best friend. They are predators. And their main prey is slugs and snails. They I know about every creature that attacks slugs, Richard. Believe me, I'd like to have, you know, I would never move an amazing creature like this, even inside of a state. But I would not be unhappy if they showed up in my own garden. They prey on slugs and snails. Their downside is my understanding is they also do go into the ground and prey on the occasional earthworm. And they are, if I am correct, you can find some good information about them online, and I think you're going to find all of it mostly on websites from the Texas State Extension Service, and my friend Howard Garrett, the dirt doctor, I'm sure has written about them. But they are creatures of moisture. Now, last year was a year where we had what I consider a lot of rain. I know it was the average amount, but we also had no heat wave, so it seemed like the soil stayed moist all year long. Was that your experience?
Yeah, for the most part. My garden's actually built in the middle of what used to be a swimming pool back in the 20s and 30s.
An in-ground pool?
Yeah, concrete.
And you filled it in with soil?
They did years ago.
Oh,
yeah. I put my garden in there.
So, but I guess because even though they probably left the drains open and everything in the bottom, the drainage is probably pretty poor.
Actually, it has really good drainage.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's interesting.
Well, yeah. When they filled it in, I think they filled in the bottom of it with a bigger, like, the concrete from around the edges.
Right.
So it made a lot of empty spaces down in there.
And then right, and also probably, more importantly, kept the drain from being clogged up right away with dirt.
Yeah,
so these are considered largely beneficial. There's certainly no harm to you or to your crops. There is a parasite of dogs called the arrow worm. But that's just like a very common worm that dogs pick up. Vets are very familiar with it. And it doesn't have this kind of crazy head. And I don't think people really ever see the worms. They just, vets have that wonderful experience when they worm the dogs. But these things are out there killing your slugs and snails, and they're really cool. So I would do nothing to get rid of them, but I would try to take pictures of them if they come back again this summer.
Okay, I can do that. Thank you very much.
All right, man. Good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Stephanie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just ducky today. Stephanie, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
And where is Stephanie great?
We are in Newport, Washington.
Is that near Spokane?
It's a little bit farther north than Spokane, about an hour north, about an hour from Canada.
Oh, okay. Right. You can see Russia from there, right?
Yeah.
All right, what can we do for Stephanie all the way up in Washington State?
We just moved into our new property out here late last year, and the property we got had some established elderberry bushes or trees and a plum tree. I've never had anything that needed to be pruned, so I have no idea where to start.
When did you move in?
September last year.
So you've only been there a few months, really?
Correct.
So you haven't seen what you got yet?
No, when we moved in, the elderberry bushes gave us some elderberries. We were able to harvest them, and then there were a couple of plums on the tree. We didn't get a whole lot, but I know it's kind of getting to the time of year when they're supposed to be pruned.
Well, first of all, you're very lucky because elderberries contain the most potent antiviral in the plant world.
Yeah, we've done a little bit of reading on it, so we were pretty excited.
So, basically, are the plants really old?
You know, we have no idea.
Are they big? Are they overgrown? Do they look like they've been cared for?
Well, the plum tree, actually, the people before us kind of cut off the top half.
Good.
That one's probably about 10 to 12 feet high, so it's not a small, younger tree. And the elderberry bushes are about 8 feet high, so they're not really young. But they do have new growth on both of them.
Okay, so for the elderberries, first of all, you don't have to prune them.
Oh,
but they're going to produce better and they're going to look cleaner if you go out, and you're right, it's right around this time of year, the end of winter going into spring, go out and remove some of the older wood. And that should be obvious, the older, more gnarly branches as opposed to the younger green wood. But mostly they don't need anything. They're kind of wild plants. They get by pretty well on their own. But as they start to get older and overgrown, it's never a bad idea to remove old wood.
Oh, okay, great.
Now, the plums, I'm really going to want you to pay attention to the plums when they flower. Because there's all different kind of plum plants. And the flowers will help you determine what you have. When you find out whether you have American or European or Oriental plums, then you can follow some basic guides. But it's almost the same thing. Cut away some of the older wood. Keep it open. Basically, the reason they cut the top off the tree, so to speak, is that's what's called establishing a new central leader. with fruit trees, you really don't want them to get too tall because then you can't reach the top to pick the fruit or thin the fruit or anything like that. And if you have a single tree, you know, it's never going to produce as many plums as it would if it had a friend in the area.
Yeah.
So, again, very important for you to watch when it flowers this spring. You don't have to do anything to it before that. Take pictures of the flowers, find out where your local extension office is, cut off one of the flowering branches and take it in. And then you can open it up after it flowers. You can take off some of the older branches and then watch the fruit set. If there's too many fruits, sometimes plums can set so heavily that they'll actually bend and break the branches like pears. So if you get that lucky, remove a lot of the fruits from the overcrowded branches so that it'll be able to develop full-size fruits. But these are both very low-care plants. You really lucked out.
Well, that is great to know. Thank you very much. We love your show. Thanks for your help.
Oh, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn our friends in Northern Virginia that I'll be returning to Fredericksburg for the 10th anniversary of the Fredericksburg Home and Garden Show at the Fredericksburg Expo and Conference Center in Fredericksburg. What a shock. Saturday and Sunday, March 14th and 15th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to save your African violets and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, African violets. What do you do when they go into decline? Can a failing African violet be saved? What's the best way to make lots of African violets from one you especially like? And what do these popular plants need for their daily care? We'll cover it all when we get to the question of the week. Before that, lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Nate. How are you?
I'm good.
Where are you, man?
I live in Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. A very nice neighborhood. What can we do for Nate in Chestnut Hill?
I have a series of small raised beds that I use to raise vegetables, and they are all on the north aspect of my house, and I've got a very shaded lot, so we get a minimum of morning sunshine, and some good afternoon sunshine. But I was more interested because the total square footage of this, which I'm dividing up amongst four raised beds, is about 70 square feet. And
that's a tiny little thing, Nate.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, in Western Civ class when I was in, you know, junior high, they talked about feudalism and fallow fields. And I was wondering how much that holds true for sort of yard gardens as opposed to, you know, industrial agriculture.
You got 70 square feet,
yeah,
you can't afford to let 2 inches go fallow.
Right. Okay.
Now, the only time any of my raised beds have, quote, gone fallow is when I've gotten exhausted in the springtime and would just let a weed take over one for the course of a season. You know, purslane, right, and chickweed are real good at being an unofficial cover crop for that. But no, you don't have to let anything go fallow or use a cover crop or anything like that. As long as you're applying fresh compost to the bed, I'm more concerned about the fact that these poor things are sun-starved. What are you growing?
I grow tomatoes and arugula, which we did last year. And what we saw was in that bed particularly, it's on the northwest corner of the house. So it gets sunshine probably starting like around noon, I would guess, in the summertime.
That's
and
rough.
The plants got big, but they didn't bear fruit until kind of late in the summer. And I can't really change the orientation of the beds, unfortunately. The front of the house has a huge maple tree on it, which,
right,
is the south exposure.
Okay.
So I was wondering, basically, how can I make the best of that situation?
What did you feed these things?
You know, this is our second year in the place, and we didn't do, you know, much. So, you know, I would be looking to, you know, get compost and fertilizer going. But this year we, you know, planted them in soil that we kind of tilled up on our own.
But you did build raised beds.
Yeah, so the raised beds are there.
And it's in your backyard or an adjacent yard?
Yep, it's in the backyard.
Did you check for lead?
No.
Okay. You're in a nice urban area, but you're still in an urban area. So before you go fooling around with your bare hands in that soil anymore, I want you to go online, go to your state extension service, which is Penn State Soil Lab, and get a lead and heavy metal test done. It's not that expensive, and you may find that you don't want to be inhaling that dirt or growing things in it.
Okay.
You may find out it's perfectly safe, but whenever people are in an urban area, you have to be careful because of the lead paint that was used and even the lead gasoline that was used. A friend of mine wound up buying a house and nobody told him there used to be a car repair shop on the site. And, you know, his lead levels were like through the roof. Now, since you are so challenged, if your soil's safe, that's great, then just add compost to your raised beds. But if you don't get sun until noontime, I would go crazy with salad greens, with herbs. I would put in some potatoes. You can even plant garlic in the fall. But for fruiting crops like tomatoes and peppers and anything else of that nature you might want to grow, there has to be a great community garden near you.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. And to your point, I mean, the arugula grew like wild, and so did the herb garden. The herb garden got, you know, was overgrown before we knew what to do with it.
Exactly. And so play your aces. There's an old line in agriculture. If you have lack of sun, think roots and shoots, not flowering plants. Flowering plants require the most sun. And disease-prone flowering plants like tomatoes require morning sun. So you're 0-2.
I got it.
On that. But there should be a nice community garden nearby. And then once you've established that your soil is safe, go nuts with herbs, go nuts with greens. I mean, kale, even plants like broccoli, just not things that develop a flower, the flower falls off, and then develops a fruit. Those are 8 hours of sun a day, and most of them prefer even more than that. But things like potatoes and salad greens and herbs, they can do quite well in an area like yours.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. That's a big help.
All right. Good luck, Nate.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Elena, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Now, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing your name. How does it go?
Elena.
Elena. Okay. Very good. And where are you, Elena?
I live in Royersford outside of Philadelphia.
Very good. What can we do for Elena in Royersford?
We just moved into the area, into a house in June, and we had a very large plant growing on, probably an 8-foot trellis. It grows all the way to the top and then over the side. And it had the original sticker on it that said clematis.
Oh, okay.
So when we bought the house, we were expecting these gorgeous characteristic purple blooms, and so we've lived there now throughout most of the end of the summer and the fall and never seen any blooms, and so I was wondering what I could possibly do to help it along a little bit.
Okay. Now, when you say it had a sticker on it, was it a plant tag with a scientific name, or was it just some kind of quirky little garden thing that said clematis?
No, it was from the store. It was one of the plant tags that was looped around it.
Excellent, excellent. And do you still have it?
I do, but I don't have it.
No, that's all right.
Right,
that's oh right. Like I'm a clematis expert. Like, you know, I know enough about clematis to get into trouble. But the fact that you have the tag means you're totally okay. And I'm going to tell you what to do. I want you to write down a resource. There
okay.
is a guy, it's Raymond Evison, Evison.
Okay.
He has been on the show many times. He is the most renowned breeder of what he would call, because he's British, clematis in the world. He is renowned. His stuff is in the Royal Gardens. He's been honored at the Philadelphia Flower Show. And his websites are incredibly informative. Now, before we go into what I'm going to tell you to do, there are two rules that clematis of any type must follow. The bottom of the plant has to be in total shade, and the top of the plant has to get full sun.
Okay.
Are those requirements being met?
You know, the bottom probably doesn't have full shade. Probably first thing in the morning it gets some of the dawn.
Oh, but then it's exposed to direct sun the rest of the day?
Yeah, the top is definitely exposed to sun all day.
Okay, that's good.
I think the roots probably get some sun, too.
And you were there towards the mid-end of summer through fall. What was the greenery like?
It's overtaking the whole trellis. I mean, it is a massive plant. It's very fertile, but it's just, I didn't even see any buds at all, nothing.
Okay, but you saw a lot of greenery.
Yes.
Okay, and not a lot of old dead wood.
No.
Okay, good. So there's two things that are going to have to be done. You're going to have to rig up something that's going to shade okay. the base. Seriously, Raymond explained to me on the show, which, you know, because I was saying, how does this happen in nature? And he said when he would go trolling for plants up in, like, the Himalayas and stuff, they would never find a clematis growing alone. It would be growing up through another plant. And the base of the clematis, where the roots were, would be all the way at the bottom of this big bushy plant. And then the vines would curl through the plant, using the plant for support, and would burst out the top, and that's where you would see the flowers. But the bottom would stay cool and shaded. So, I mean, there might be just some sort of a little box you could make up out of nice-looking wood to box it over, keep that area down by the roots shaded and cool. No matter what, that will help you out. And then find your plant tag go to Raymond's website. Once again, it's Raymond Evison, E-V-I-S-O-N, and look up your clematis. You probably have the common name and the scientific name. There are somewhere between 3 and 6 what are called different groups of clematis that must be pruned differently, that flower at different times of the year. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to give general advice. It's apple trees, I can tell you how to prune any apple tree. Peach trees, I can tell you how to prune any peach tree. You get into clematis, and it's like, I need to know what group it is. Is it a Hugh Jackman? Is it this? Is it that? So using the information on your tag, go to Raymond's website. It'll tell you exactly what group it's in and exactly how to prune it. And it will probably reemphasize the importance of shading the root system.
Okay.
So, but for now, okay, look it up, find out when to prune it so you'll be ready and how to prune it. Shade the bottom, and I suspect you should be in really good shape.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Don, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Don. How are you?
Doing well. Long-time listener. I really enjoy your show.
Why, thank you, sir. Where are you?
West Windsor, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Don in the Garden State?
I have a large boxer, 100 pounds. He's a male.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an electric fence, so he pretty much has run of the yard. And each summer when he urinates, he leaves lots of yellow patches all over our lawn. Other than the obvious, which is to not let him run around all over the lawn, I was wondering, is there anything that I could do to prevent those yellow stains from coming?
Yes, but you don't mean an actual electric fence, do you, Don?
No,
Not like in Jurassic Park or, you know, anything.
No. It's a wire that's buried under the lawn,
right,
and he's got a collar that beeps if he gets too close. Yeah.
This question comes up a lot, and our veterinary experts out at the University of Penn are always happy when we field this, because there's some really stupid stuff that is suggested on the internet. And instead, we have managed to get really good information from both our veterinary experts and from our lawn care experts, and everyone agrees. Oddly enough, the first part of the solution is to make sure the dog gets lots of water. The more water the dog gets to drink, the more dilute the material that comes out the other end. The most damage to lawns is done when dogs have been withheld water, or they've been inside the house for a really long period of time, and they go out and they release like half a day or a full day's worth. The more often they can go out, the more free access to water they have, the less damaging it is to lawns. So that's the first part. One of the other things is good lawn care. I presume because you live in New Jersey that you have a cool season lawn like fescue or bluegrass.
That's correct.
So you should never, especially with the dog, be cutting it anywhere below 3 inches, because the lower you cut, the easier it is to do damage. The higher the cut, the better the lawn is going to look no matter what, but there will also be more grass to utilize what in a diluted form is actually a nutrient for lawns.
Okay.
So keep that lawn cut as high as possible. Give the dog free access to water. Now, if you have a living situation, as a lot of people do, when, you know, the dog has to hold for a long time until you get home from work or something like that, if there's long periods involved and the dog doesn't have free access to the yard, then it would be worth your while to have a little training scenario that when you get home or whoever gets home, that working with a treat, with a reward, you lead the dog to like the corner of the yard you care about the least, or maybe to a place where you have stones instead of grass or something, an out of the way spot, and train the dog to go right there, give them the reward right away. So then when they see you come home, they will want to go to their spot. Gradually, you can even eliminate the reward and just substitute praise. If you're there and you see it, one of the easiest things you can do in the summer is just have a hose handy or a watering can handy and dilute it on the spot. That's going to be more successful than anything you can do. But a combination of dilution, a high lawn cut, and it sounds like this dog is going to be easily trainable to have a special spot that's going to belong to him. And, you know, as I said, you can do whatever you want with that area back there. But if you want to be super clever, that might be an area where you have a hose right there, too. So right. As soon as he goes, you dilute it. But I guarantee the more you dilute everything across the board, the less you're going to notice anything.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, Don. Thank you. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that our old friend Lee Reich, our fruit tree and pruning expert, will hold a grafting workshop at Bartram's Gardens, sponsored by the Philadelphia Orchard Project, on Saturday, March 14th from 1 to 4. We just heard about this. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to save your African violets and take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week: how to raise African violets carefully and perfectly, and of course, what to do after you fail miserably and the poor things look like they're dying. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Herbert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing fine, Herbert. How are you, sir?
I'm not doing too bad. I wanted to share with you my experience with some elm trees down in Middletown, Delaware.
Okay. Middletown, Delaware. You actually say elm trees?
Yes. We moved into a development 10 years ago. The development planted trees along the curb. and the trees that were planted along the curb suffered from what I was told was elm tree disease. And over the last 3 to 4 years, the trees started not blooming, looking very bad, and then they just did not bloom last year. So what I ended up having to do was I cut the two trees down that were in front of my home.
Right.
And I talked to several arborists, and they've told me that a lot of the elm trees in North America have come down with some type of blight or some type of disease, and it's nothing you can do.
Yeah, a disease called Dutch elm disease wiped out most of the elm trees in the United States, but this was ages and ages ago. Now, there are trees called Chinese elms that are unaffected, although the American elm, when it wasn't being dropped down by Dutch elm disease, was a good tree for cities.
There were about maybe 20 to 30 trees along the block that were affected. Now, my neighbor, her trees, she was able to water them, and she kind of saved hers, but I would say the other 25 trees that were on the street, it looks like a horror movie. They're not doing anything. They just look like they're dead trees.
And these things were planted how long ago?
10 years ago. You got to remember, the two trees in front of my home, I've actually cut them down because they did not look like they want to come back to life.
Okay.
So my question, there's a 6 foot wide by 38 foot long plot where the two trees were.
Mm-hmm.
They were evenly spaced in front of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And now I want to know, how do I remove the roots, and then what type of tree would I plant there that's going to be a good tolerant tree that's going to grow, prosper, and not give me any
okay.
issue?
You can't remove the roots. You absolutely are physically incapable of removing the roots. That needs specialized equipment. I'm thinking the parts of the sidewalk would be torn up, and you'd also have to make sure that there's no piping underground. You wouldn't want to impact the sewer line leaving your house. There might be underground electrical cables. And you just cut these trees down yourself. You just cowboyed them down?
Well, actually, I had my landscaper. He came through with a chainsaw, and he hauled them away. And he did it actually back in, I'm going to say, September, October of last year.
Well, even if you don't impact the sidewalk, it's going to cost you a good $1,000, maybe $2,000 to get the stumps pulled. What I'm going to suggest, do you really need trees there?
I think it would add beauty to the street line and to the development, and I just don't want to be the only one that doesn't have anything there.
And you're the only one whose trees died.
Well, there's other trees that are dead along the street, but no one else has dealt with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something because I didn't want to have two dead trees in front of my home.
Well, here's your two options. What I would do, because obviously the look of this area is going to change. You can have the trees cut down and ground down to where the stump will be taken down to a little bit below ground. You don't have to worry about water, electrical, or the pavement when you do something like that. And then you could box out the area and build a nice raised bed on top. And in that raised bed, you could plant things that would even achieve the same height, but would grow well within that box. That would save you the money of tearing out the stumps. Again, we don't even know that you can tear out the stumps without causing tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage if there's a sewer line or electrical running under there. Your other option is to go around to these other homeowners in spring. If their trees truly don't leaf out, then maybe you as a community can come up with a common plan so that it would look right if you all did essentially the same thing.
Excellent advice, Mike. Thank you very much for taking my call, and I'm going to follow up with the other homeowners, and we're going to get something that looks uniform and beautiful.
I think that's the answer, man. Good luck.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Chris. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Woodbury, New Jersey, almost directly south of the runways of the Philadelphia Airport.
So you hear a lot of planes going overhead, huh?
Yeah, we get our share, but it's not as bad as trains. Planes fly further away than trains do.
All right, what can we do for Chris?
Okay, I've got these black, I call them puffballs. They're about the size of a baseball, and I get maybe 20 or 30 in the front lawn. And the location moves around from time to time, but they keep on coming up. I sort of kick them with a foot and pick them up and put them in the garbage, but they keep on coming back. How do I get rid of them and make sure they don't come back?
You don't kick them. We just had a professor from St. Joe's University on the show talking about the different fungal organisms in the garden. And puffballs, which is, you know, their accepted common name, are one of them. And in some cases, when you have a nuisance mold in a lawn, it means that somebody cut down a tree but left the roots in the ground, or that construction debris was buried and then the lawn was grown on top of that. And the mushrooms that appear above that are these fungal organisms helping this underground wood to decompose. But it's my understanding that with these puffballs, what happens is spores move in, just blow in on the wind from surrounding areas, land in the right conditions, and then make this ball. And that ball, imagine it as a giant dandelion puffball, because that's essentially what it is, except it's filled with spores as opposed to dandelion seeds. So when you kick it or disturb it, you spread billions of these things, most of which are going to land somewhere else on your lawn. So you haven't realized it, but you've actually been growing these for fun and profit.
Well, what's the profit, Mike? I don't get the fun.
Yeah. Okay, so who cuts your lawn?
I do.
And how high is it when you're done cutting?
About 2.5 to 3 inches.
Okay. You want to make sure it's 3 inches. What kind of a mower do you use?
It's a rotary mower, a standard everyday lawn mower.
So very important, before the next season starts, make sure you get a new blade or you get your old one sharpened. And then how do you water your lawn?
Very infrequently. I get enough dew and rain here that it doesn't need a lot of water over the summer.
Okay, good, because I want you not to water very deliberately then as we go forward. Now, these things are harmless, and you have two options. When you see them appear, one of the things you could do is to kind of capture them. You would take like a plastic bag or a paper bag and surround it and try to lift the thing up and then close it off, and then do that for a little while, and that way not distribute the spores all over your garden. Another way to deal with them would be to get what's called a flame weeder. Burns-O-Matic makes a very simple one. It's just like a shepherd's hook. At one end, you screw in a little camp stove-sized bottle of propane. It's got an electronic igniter, and then at the end of the long wand, a flame comes off. If when these things are small, you just desiccate them with the flame weeder, you won't harm the grass, but you'll destroy the ability of the spores to regenerate. You get them under control for one season, you shouldn't see them again. If you get them under control and they keep popping up over and over and over again, I would suggest that in the fall, you have what's called a core aeration performed on your lawn. Have you ever had your lawn aerated?
No, that's where they pull the plugs of soil out?
Exactly. And that would improve the drainage. All of these fungal organisms are creatures of excessive moisture, and it's also very good for your lawn to decrease the density of the soil. But if you just handle them carefully for a single season, now knowing what's going on, that, you know, every time you disturb it or let it get to full size, it sends out these billions of little seeds, you should be able to get it under control in a single season. But the nice thing is it's not harming anything. They're just this weird thing of nature. Everything has to be somewhere.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mike.
All right, Chris, good luck.
Okay.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. African violet care and damage control. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read us this week's intriguing question, if you please.
Sure, Mike. Sandy in Chester County, PA writes, I have two African violet houseplants that are between 15 and 17 years old. They are kept on a plant stand near a window that faces southeast and were thriving until recently. One of the plants has started to wilt and droop, basically looking like it's ready to die. I have cut back on watering as I thought maybe it was too moist, but to no avail. The top of the other one fell right off when I brushed the plant with my hand. I promptly placed the broken part, leaves, flowers, and thick stem into a glass of water. How can I save it? Can I re-root it? Or should it be put directly back into the soil?
Well, whenever anybody, quote, thinks that their plant soil might be too moist, it's generally code for I've been drowning the poor things for months. So I asked her if those pots felt heavy, which is a sure sign of water saturation, or light, which would indicate lack of water.
Well, Sandy dodged your actual question, but did reply that the pots do seem to be moister than usual. Then she added, and I was getting those little gnat things and started using the microbial mosquito bits to kill them about 6 months ago.
Aha! That means she's using BTI granules to try and control an infestation of fungus gnats. And those annoying little houseplant pests are themselves a sign of overwatering.
Okay, so let's assume that she drowned the poor things. What should she do with the one in the glass of water? And is the droopy one a lost cause?
You know, the only thing I personally know about African violets is to not overwater them or expose them to direct sun. So I called out to Mary Schaefer, president of the Delaware Valley Gesneriad Society.
Gesner what?
Gesneriad. It's the name of the very large plant family that African violets belong to. At least it's close to the name. It's best I can do. Both the national and local societies are very active, and they're great sources of information.
What does Mary recommend for the decapitated one?
Take it out of the water. Scrape off all the mushy stuff around the stump. She actually said mushy stuff. And remove the worst of the leaves, leaving 3 to 6 good ones. Then get a 3-inch pot with good drainage and fill it with a light, loose, soil-free mix that contains a lot of perlite. Place the cleaned-up crown in the center of the moist soil mix and tamp it down lightly around the crown. Then cover the pot with a plastic bag, place it out of direct sun, away from heat and drafts, and just leave it alone for 3 to 4 weeks. Then begin to acclimate it back to the world by opening the bag gradually over several days.
How will you know if it's better?
When a gentle tug no longer pulls it out of the pot no more.
I thought the classic way to root African violets was with a stem cutting.
And that's the suggestion for the other plant. Take the best-looking leaves and root them individually in 2 to 3-inch wide pots filled with a moist, soil-free mix, again with lots of perlite, and use the loose plastic bag trick for humidity. Interestingly, Mary said to not leave a lot of stem attached to the leaves, just 1 to 1.5 inches. The shorter the stem, the better the result, she told me.
I would have thought the opposite.
Well, so would I, which is why I actually ask people who know what they're doing. And I learned something else. Mary says that a single rooted African violet leaf will yield multiple plants, so each should get their own small container after they develop.
How small?
Well, Mary says to follow the rule of three. The diameter of the pot should only be 1/3 the diameter of the plant. So if your African violet measures 6 inches from leaf edge to leaf edge, it should be in a little 2-inch diameter pot. They really like to be root bound. She adds that most enthusiasts repot their plants at least once a year, with right around now, February, March, the ideal time.
But not into bigger pots.
Well, sure, into bigger pots if the plants have gotten that much larger. But I'll bet you that the main reason they do it is to make sure the soil hasn't gotten heavy over time, which is what I suspect happened to our listeners' plants. Mary warns that most potting mixes are just too dense and heavy for African violets to begin with, and suggests that people use the lightest possible soil-free mix they can find and amend it with lots of perlite.
Sounds like you found a fellow perlite fan.
Yeah, baby! Gotta love those little white pieces of pop volcanic glass. There's nothing better at improving drainage and keeping vitally needed air around the roots of plants.
Anything else?
African violets always keep the plants on the dry side and give them bright light but no direct sun, which, yes, can be really tricky. That's why people with a lot of these plants tend to keep them under lights, the reward for which can be plants that are blooming 9 or 10 months out of the year. Well, that sure was some good advice about growing, propagating, and just plain not killing your African violets, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to do violence to my violets if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please include your location.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Sob! Rich Banowitz is now You Bet Your Garden's sole webpage wonder as we bid a fond but sad farewell to our favorite internet she-devil, Sarah Kazar, as she leaves to experience the travel adventure of a lifetime before she, quote, gets as old as McGrath and can't do it anymore. Nice, Sarah. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our waterlogged editor is Al Banks. Soggy Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, drains poorly. Our production assistant is Farah Al-Yukut. I may be ancient Mike McGrath, but I keep my drainage superb with perlite so I can see you again next week. Does painting the porch a certain hue of blue keep out stinging insects or restless spirits? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what Haint Blue can do for you. Plus your fabulous phone calls.